are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, June 28th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Ian Millhiser, editor, Think Progress, Justice, on the horror that is the Supreme Court. And then Jane McAlevey, labor organizer, author, on the Supreme Court's kneecapping of public sector unions. Now what? Meanwhile, our government still holding thousands of kids. The DNC rolls back the role of superdelegates. Trump's approval rating jumps a bit while Putin announces when he wants to see him in his office. Meanwhile, Mad Dog Mattis in South Korea says we are still an ally. But is he even in the loop? Republican House fails again to pass an immigration bill. And Virginia, the latest state to join in on an opioid Purdue Pharma suit. All this and more on today's program. Let's face it, though, folks. The story of the day of the week. I mean, yesterday we were talking about, we should get someone like Ian Millhiser on, or maybe Jane McAlevey on, to talk about this rash of horrible Supreme Court rulings. I mean, just this week, we had the Supreme Court upholding the Muslim ban, ignoring, unlike they did in Masterpiece Cake Homophobia Theater, or whatever it is, the proclamations of Donald Trump that this was about religion, not about national security. The Supreme Court went on to effectively gut Section 3 of the Voting Rights Act. This has gotten very little attention. By raising the bar in which it takes to prove that a gerrymandered district is racist. And this, in addition to maintaining the gerrymanders in Texas and North Carolina. Also, another horrible ruling that did not get much attention was that the Supreme Court, now recall, you've had states that have passed laws that have said physicians are required in their consultations, in delivering medicine to women who come in, they are required to say specific things about abortion. Like there are other options, whatever it is. They are mandated to say certain things to their patients. However, the Supreme Court found, and they found that not to be an infringement on a doctor's First Amendment rights, right? They're compelled to a certain speech that has, let's be clear, no medical bearing. No medical bearing whatsoever. However, they have not let stand a California law that has said if you are posing as a women's health clinic and you do not provide the implied range of women's health applications, I guess, like providing abortions or providing contraceptive or If you offer only as family planning, like, we can turn you to an adoption agency. California had a law that said you must make it clear that you don't provide these services, abortion services, that they're available at other places. And the Supreme Court struck that down. So essentially, two standards for a First Amendment in terms of what you're compelled to speak. One, if you're a doctor, they can compel you to say certain things that have no medical benefit. On the other hand, if you're pretending like you're a doctor or a clinic, you don't have to have a caveat that says, I'm neither of those things. And that was all just in like the first, and of course the Janus ruling, where unions are no longer allowed to require people they represent to pay for that representation. Long-term plan to kneecap public sector unions. But the final blow, of course, and where am I looking over here? This one? The final blow, of course, is Anthony Kennedy has announced his retirement. And there does not seem to be really anything that can be done about this in terms of preventing the next Supreme Court justice to be seated. Some people are floating different plans. You know, the Senate being completely shut down, that seems highly unlikely to me. Or some combination of John McCain not showing up to vote and Susan Collins deciding that she's going to take her first principled vote in the history of her career and actually maintain her pledge to prevent an anti-abortion judge to be seated. Maybe she could change her mind. But here is Jeffrey Toobin on CNN basically outlining what's going to happen going forward. Now, understand, the guy who qualifies his statement sitting next to Jeffrey Toobin is Ken Cuccinelli. He was the attorney general of Virginia when Bob McDonald wanted to have a law that said that if you went in to get an abortion, you literally had to have a vaginal probe to provide an ultrasound for kids. So just understand, Ken Cuccinelli is supposedly the one who's trying to say like, well, all right, listen to this.
We talk about Supreme Court too much in abstractions about dignity and who's qualified and who's not qualified. Let's talk facts. Let's talk about what America is going to be like that's different. You are going to see 20 states pass laws banning abortion outright, just banning abortion, and because they know that there are now going to be 5 votes on the Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade. And abortion will be illegal in a significant part of the United States in 18 months. There is just no doubt about that. And that's why these seats matter so much, because one of my favorite lines about the Supreme Court was by Justice Robert Jackson, who served on the court in the 1940s and 50s. And he said, "We are not final because we are infallible. We are infallible because we are final." Somebody has the last word. And here it's the Supreme Court. And right. Roe v. Wade is doomed. It is gone. Because Donald Trump won the election, and because he's going to have the chance to appoint 2 Supreme Court justices.
Wow. Just still sitting with the gravity of what you just said. How quickly do you think that those changes will come on the state level?
Yeah, first of all, I don't agree with Jeffrey that there are going to be not 20 states. There will be some states, but they'll be in a very distinct minority. You will see this now is an open political debate. People have run for governor. I've run for governor in my state. And while I didn't do this, lots of people have. When this question has come up, they say, oh, that's a federal issue. Well, all overturning Roe v. Wade does is, as Jeffrey points out, it returns it to the states. So then it suddenly becomes a state issue in 50 states, and it's a part of every state election, and it becomes actually more important in those state races than it is today, and that's if it happens. I don't see the 18-month time schedule of Jeffrey Toobin happening, but it is possible sometime in the foreseeable future.
Yeah, in other words, what Ken Cuccinelli is saying there is, yeah, it's going to happen. It's going to happen. Without a doubt, it's going to happen. And this is, we're going to be looking, maybe it won't be 18 months out, although I would be very surprised if it wasn't. That we don't have half the states or there are, 20 states in this country where it's been outlawed. Now, understand this is how it goes, right? The new justice is seated. Maybe that happens if McConnell has his way, and he probably will. That'll happen in October. And then, really, once the midterm elections are over, if there are any people to be inaugurated on a state level, state elections, starting in January, you will see multiple states, starting in January, probably on day one, outlawing abortion. And it will become the law in these states. One of those states will be the first one to try and get to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court will expedite it more than likely, and they will find that they will overturn Roe v. Wade. You will lose the right to an abortion as a federal right. States will be able to ban abortion. And then on top of that, the question will be, will the federal government, will Congress say it's illegal for you to cross state lines to get an abortion? This all remains to be seen. In the meantime, we've got to take a break. We'll come back and we'll talk to Ian Millhiser, who may have some answers on this. Just want to remind you, this program relies on your support. If you have the financial means to become a member, head over to jointhemajorityreport.com right now. As our way of saying thank you, we give you some extra content every day. But things are going to start getting super, super ugly. And that's the best case scenario. Because, we're literally sitting in the office, and we'll talk more about this later in the program. We're literally sitting in the office talking about, what are the are folks living in New York, East Coast states maybe, and some West Coast states, and maybe one or two states in the middle, sending out drones with abortion drugs or, doing underground railroads. I mean, it's going to be ugly.
They're already doing the drone thing in Europe, and I feel like we need to get ready. Also, I should make the point that if states do ban abortion, it's going to be in a very undemocratic way. Because I just saw a statistic from Think Progress. There is no state where public support for banning abortion is even 25%. So,
I have no doubt they're going to do it. They're going to do it because they've been elected representatives, and that's what's going to happen. I think we could probably find a half a dozen major issues that these states have passed, under Republican control, that would be also contrary to where public opinion is.
That's the other thing that's scary about that Cuccinelli thing is, aside from all the stuff they're going to do legislatively, is they know that this energizes their base in all the states that now get to make these new laws.
Indeed. All right, we got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Ian Millhiser.
Someone so
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Ian Millhiser. He is the justice editor at thinkprogress.org and author of Injustices. I'd say, and it's about to get a lot worse. Ian, welcome to the program.
Yeah, no, in case you've wondered what the Gilded Age looks like, we're about to all find out.
You know, it's funny that you say that, because I pre-recorded an interview with Jane McAlevey that I'm going to play right after you, where she wrote a book specifically on, you know, and I was talking to her about the implications of the Janus ruling, and the name of her book is, you know, dealing with the new Gilded Age, anticipating what we're seeing today. So, all right, we had some major rulings this week that are now almost secondary in the sense that they were very bad rulings. If we look back on Anthony Kennedy's year, in addition to these rulings, stuff that people anticipated he was sort of waiting for in terms of the gerrymandering, the court punted. And let me just get your take on what do you think that's about now that you know he's retiring?
Right. Yeah, I think when you look back at this past term, it's clear that he made the decision to retire at some point this year. And he just didn't want to hand down decisions that he knew were going to be overruled 5 minutes after he left. And so, you know, he punted on the big gerrymandering cases. He punted on the case dealing with whether or not you can discriminate against people if your religion tells you to. And then, you know, I think the craziest decision he made was in the Muslim ban case. He joined Chief Justice Roberts' opinion, which more or less says, like, oh, so long as the president can come up with a legitimate sounding reason why he wants to do this, we won't look at all the past racist statements he said in the past, explaining that he's doing it for some other reason. Kennedy joined that opinion, and then he wrote a separate concurrence where he basically said, yeah, no, this is really bad, and the president shouldn't do this, but I'm kind of powerless to do anything about it, so we're just going to let it happen. So, you know, looking back on it, he looks like a man who, you know, spent his last term on the court in a senior slump and, you know, who didn't want to fight any big fights and who didn't want to get himself into a position where he was just going to hand out a decision that wasn't going to last very long. And so this term, you know, the sort of decisions you got from this court, the court this term, look a whole lot like the sort of decisions that you would have gotten if Kennedy had already been replaced in many cases.
You know, I got to say, it's funny because for as long as I've talked to people about the Supreme Court, Kennedy was always slightly, I guess, an enigma. And I got to say, the guy has really revealed himself. I mean, I don't think history is going to be very kind to this guy who sort of like backs out in a very sniveling fashion. You know, I mean, because who knows whether or not these things would have been overturned. But the idea that he didn't want to leave his mark on the court in any fashion is sort of shocking to me.
Yeah, I mean, history is not going to look well on this guy. I mean, here's the thing about Anthony Kennedy. I mean, Justice Kennedy is really, really conservative. I mean, people would, like, appeal to him because he was our best shot of getting one of the conservatives to flip their vote. And advocates who, like, you know, like, most of the people who know a lot about the Supreme Court are lawyers who advocate and who may have a case in front of the Supreme Court. And they're not going to talk badly about the guy who's their swing vote because, you know, you don't want to piss them off. You need them. But most of his decisions were bad. He wrote Citizens United, for Christ's sake.
Right.
And I think that the way to understand his decision to retire now is one of two things were going to happen. Either he retires under Donald Trump, and if he retires under Donald Trump, then, you know, then all the gay rights decisions potentially go away. Abortion goes away. You know, all the stuff we think is good that he did, you know, the stuff for preserving civil rights laws, that goes away if he retires under Donald Trump. Or he could retire, you know, wait and pretend and leave the court under, you know, whoever the next president is, you know, Kamala Harris, Kirsten Gillibrand, whoever it is, he leaves under that person. And then Citizens United goes away. Then this union's decision goes away. Then all of the decisions saying that rich people get what they want in this country, those decisions go away. But he gets to keep. But we get to keep abortion. We get to keep gay rights. And what Kennedy says, you know what? I care more about rich people than I do about gay people and women.
It's enlightening and stunning and disgusting. All right. Well, I want to move a little bit from the sort of this first version of history about Kennedy, because he has now couldn't be less relevant. Right. And the question is, there's a couple of questions, and let's start with it with order of sort of, I guess, what would happen in temporally. Is there any mechanism to deny Donald Trump this pick, at least until there's a chance in November that a new Senate would be elected? Now, and that's a long shot in and of itself, but is there any way to deny him this pick for this session of the Senate?
Yeah, I mean, it's called a floor vote. If there are 51 senators who don't want, or maybe even fit, but just 50, because McCain is still in Arizona, then, you know, if two Republican senators decide that they don't want Donald Trump to replace Anthony Kennedy with whoever Trump picks, then, then this nomination is stopped. And as it turns out, there happened to be two Republican senators, Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, who at least claim to be pro-choice. And so the decision that Susan Collins needs to make, the decision that Lisa Murkowski needs to make, is they are going to vote on whether or not to overrule Roe v. Wade. I mean, that's what this vote is. I mean, it's about a lot of things. But one of the things that this vote is about is Susan Collins going to overrule Roe v. Wade? And Susan Collins can decide that she does not want to overrule Roe v. Wade, and Lisa Murkowski can decide that she does not want to overrule Roe v. Wade. And maybe after they make it clear to Trump that that's not happening, he'll pick someone else who's more moderate and can get more votes. But yeah, I mean, there is a mechanism to stop whoever Trump's nominee is from being confirmed. It's called a no vote in his confirmation.
Okay. And let me just remind folks about Susan Collins when it comes to these things. She voted for the health care repeal based upon a promise by Mitch McConnell that I think never materialized, and I never heard about Susan Collins ever having a problem with it again. So, Ian, I don't want to put you in a position where you have to bet anything of value, but I'm willing to make a wager out there. For, let's say, I don't want to go overboard, but I'll do 50% of what I've saved for my kids' college education that Susan Collins is going to say, like, we just don't know how they're going to vote. There's no way for it because they won't tell us.
Yeah, Susan Collins is counting on her voters. Susan Collins wants to think her voters are stupid. You know, I mean, Susan Collins is the senator from a blue state. She is the senator from the state of Maine. And, like, she is trusting on the, you know, the ability that she is going to be able to lie to her voters. She's going to be able to say that she has no idea, like, what this person's going to do. And she, and she's going to rely on that when she runs for re-election in 2020. And if she tells her voters, oh, I don't know if this person's going to get rid of Roe or not, she is lying to them.
Right.
I mean, you know, that's what it comes down to. She's a senator from a blue state. And if she wants to run her next election, having voted to overrule Roe v. Wade, that she can run her next election having voted to overrule Roe v. Wade, because that's what she is voting for. And, you know, I agree with you. Susan Collins is terrible. I don't have a high degree of confidence that she's going to do the right thing here.
But that's the choice she's facing. All right.
But that's, you know,
so let's go down the line here.
To go into her next election like this.
What
was that?
I want to move forward in time. To where Susan Collins behaves exactly true to form. She votes for this person with a, you know, so I met with them in private and I had a pretty good inkling that they're going to protect a woman's right to choose. And then January comes, the new state governments are elected. The new Supreme Court justice is seated. And Jeffrey Toobin says 18 months we'll have 20 states that have outlawed abortion in their states. One of those states will head up cases, if not multiple ones, will head up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court will choose one. They will overturn Roe v. Wade. It becomes a state matter. Let me ask you this. Can then a Republican, if the Republicans control the Senate and the House at that point, can they... can they write a bill that says it's illegal to cross state lines to get an abortion?
Probably no. Probably they couldn't write that bill because there's a constitutional right to travel. If you are a U.S. citizen, you are allowed to travel, you know, across state borders. You know, there are some laws saying that, you know, prohibiting, like, transporting a minor across state borders for the purpose of engaging in sexual trafficking. But I think that they probably aren't going to keep people from Texas from going up to New York to get an abortion. You know, what the world looks like once the day after Roe v. Wade is overruled, or after it's like boiled down to nothing, because they may not actually write the words Roe v. Wade is overruled. They'll just make the decision have no force whatsoever. But the day after that happens, once that happens, if you are rich, your life is exactly the same.
Right.
If you are rich, the only thing that changes for you is that if you need an abortion, you call up your boss and you say, hey, I need to take a few days off, and you buy a plane ticket and you go up to New York and you get your abortion there. You go to California and you get your abortion there, rather than being able to get it in a location that's more convenient. If you are poor, those are the people who are impacted. You know, and not just if you're poor. You know, if you don't have the job flexibility so that you can take those days off on the spur of the moment, so you can travel somewhere else to get an abortion. You know, if you don't have the money that you can just shell out for not just the cost of the treatment, but the plane ticket and everything else, those are the people who will be targeted for this. Rich people, even if abortion were banned in all 50 states, rich people could still go to Canada. You know, this right. is about the way we're going to treat women who aren't rich.
And in many respects, as we talk about these, the high profile facets of our lives that are going to change with a replacement for Justice Kennedy. As someone had texted me last night, like, well, you know, how bad is this going to get? And I said, I can answer that question if you tell me what color you are, how much you earn, and where you live, what state. right? I mean, that's basically what it comes down to. Those three factors will determine how your life is impacted. And so let's talk about other things that you anticipate we're going to see changed with a fifth justice who looks more like Gorsuch than Kennedy.
Yeah. So here's my biggest concern, and I'm going to disagree with you slightly about like obviously the people who are going to be hit most immediately and most clearly are going to be women, people of color, sexual minorities, and gender minorities. I mean, that's clear. But the biggest thing that concerns me about this is that not that Kennedy was great on voting rights, but Roberts is much, much worse. And Roberts is the new swing voter. And what you've seen in the states is an effort to use more and more aggressive state laws restricting the franchise. That's what voter ID laws are. That's what that North Carolina law was that just combined a bunch of ways to make it harder for black people to vote. Without Kennedy, I am 90% sure that a law like that North Carolina law is going to be upheld. And what Republican states are going to start doing in the coming years is they're going to start experimenting. They're going to start passing more and more aggressive voter suppression laws. These laws are going to target racial minorities because most African Americans, for example, vote for Democrats. And so they can look at the color of someone's skin and say, if I disenfranchise this person, I'm pretty sure I'm disenfranchising a Democrat. Right. And that'll help me get reelected. And so, you know, all of us are in this together. You know, if you start disenfranchising black voters,
I see what you're
that
saying.
Means that Democrats no longer can win elections. And if you don't like the idea of living in a one party nation, then like this impacts you. I mean, I am white and I also want to continue to have competitive elections. And that means that my fate is tied to the black people who are going to be targeted by these laws.
Right. Fair enough. So voting rights is one of those things. And we saw two examples of it this week. I mean, you mentioned North Carolina. The other is Texas, where in many respects, it struck me that Section 3 of the Voting Rights Act was not explicitly gutted. I mean, we saw Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act gutted a couple of years ago. And it seemed like that ruling in Texas attacks Section 3. Yeah. Is that an accurate read of that?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly one of its implications. So this is the Abbott case, Abbott v. Perez. And what the courts basically said here is they said that they will apply a presumption of white racial innocence to, you know, various attempts to reduce the franchise. So, like, the facts of this case are actually really unusual. In 2011, Texas drew a bunch of their state legislative maps. There were a racial gerrymander. They were drawn to maximize white people's power and to minimize the power of black people and Latinos. A court determined that, yep, that's why these maps were drawn. They were drawn for racist reasons. Got to throw them out. And then there was a period where an election was looming. The old maps were no good. A court hastily drew like, okay, well, since you've got an election coming up, you can use these hastily drawn maps that don't fix all of the problems, but it's the best I can do on short notice. Go run your election. So the court drew like a rushed map. Many of the racially gerrymandered districts were left in place in the rushed map. And then the state took that rushed map and passed it into law. So all of these districts were still there. And they'd just been passed into law twice, once in 2011, once in 2013. And what the court said in Abbott is, oh, it doesn't matter that those districts were originally drawn with racist intent. You don't just have to prove that. You have to prove specifically that when they repassed those districts in 2013, you have to show that they also had racist intent when they did it in 2013. And so you lose.
I mean,
you know, it's this. Yeah,
that's That's nuts. Like,
yeah,
I mean,
completely nuts.
It's completely nuts. I mean, if I reauthorize districts that I know have been deemed racist by a judge, how do I,
right.
how can anybody say I had any intent or that there's an absence of racist intent in my doing that? I mean, that's absurd.
Right. Yeah, no, that,
you could whitewash anything that way, right? I mean,
Yeah, the court literally just wrote whitewashing into the Constitution. Like, they didn't say that race discrimination is legal, but in a lot of civil rights cases, including a lot of voting rights cases, things turn upon what the intention of the legislature
right.
was. You know, it's not illegal to draw school districts that put one neighborhood in one district and another neighborhood in another district. That's not illegal. But if you do it because the white people live in one neighborhood and the black people live in the other neighborhood, and your purpose is to keep them separate, that's what makes it illegal, is your racist intent. And so what the Supreme Court said is, we will give every advantage we can to the racist. Like, we'll have a very strong presumption that white people are innocent and that they didn't have this intent. And if they do anything new, even if it doesn't change much of anything, that wipes the slate clean, and you have to prove anew, totally afresh. Oh yeah, like they had racist intent the second time. So, I mean, the implications for voting rights here are tremendous. Because, I mean, what is a voter ID law? You know, the reason for a voter ID law is because black people and Latinos are less likely to have photo ID than white people.
Right.
That's why the laws exist. And but like, it's not, if you weren't doing it to target racial minorities, it's much harder to challenge these things.
Right.
You know, there's nothing inherently wrong with the voter ID. The problem is that it's being done to give an advantage to one political party, because the Republicans know that if they disenfranchise black people and they disenfranchise the Latinos, that Democrats are going to lose more voters than Republicans.
Okay, so voting rights, gerrymandering, we know that abortion rights, racial justice in the form very much of voting rights and whatnot. LGBTQ rights also, like you had mentioned, Kennedy was fairly good on that relative to who's going to replace him. And what about this, the burgeoning movement to ignore law based upon your religion, right? Like, in Masterpiece Cake Homophobic Baker case, the guy was able to not make cakes for married couples that were same sex because supposedly one member or two members of the board in Colorado that looked at his case said something that was arguably, although I would argue not, but arguably prejudiced towards religion. In that instance, that completely nullifies everything. If Donald Trump goes out there and says this is a Muslim ban, that apparently has no impact on why he may have passed that ban. But okay, with that said,
right.
Where else do we see that dynamic? And then I know that you have to jump after that.
Oh yeah. So what the conservatives on the Supreme Court want to do is a massive shift and how we think about religion and what they call religious freedom cases. So, like, the law right now is that in a lot of cases, you can't treat two people differently because of their religious faith. So, like, I can say, if you're loud and obnoxious, I'm going to kick you out of my bar. But I can't say, I'm going to kick out loud and obnoxious Catholics, but I'm going to let loud and obnoxious Jews stay.
Right.
So you can treat everyone the same, but you can't distinguish between faiths.
Because religion is a protected status, right? Like, also
right.
same too with race. same too with gender, and in some states, same too with sexual identity and
right.
And same-sex relations. But, for instance, there's no status of I work for the president. That's not a protected status, right? I mean, just to
right.
clarify.
Yeah, I mean, that's
things.
The okay. whole thing with Sarah right. Huckabee. Yeah, okay. like, yeah. So, like, the law says, and, like, and this is true across various, so, like, it's illegal to discriminate against on the basis of race. And but that doesn't mean that, like, if a black person comes into your bar and is loud and obnoxious, you can kick them out for violating the policy against being loud and obnoxious. You just can't treat black people differently than you treat people of other races. Like,
right.
this is a basic feature of civil rights law. What Gorsuch wants to do, this is what Gorsuch wrote in his concurring opinion in Masterpiece Cake Shop, is he wants to change the law for religion and basically say you are protected if you take an action that is motivated by your faith. So if I think that Jesus talks to me and Jesus tells me to go into your bar and just be loud and obnoxious and, you know, start fights and all of those things, And the bartender wants to kick me out, not because of my faith, but because of the obnoxious actions I am taking that are motivated by my faith. Under Gorsuch's theory, I'm protected. I'm allowed to be loud and obnoxious. I don't have to follow the same rules everyone else does because my actions are motivated by my faith. And that's what this cake shop case was about. You had a baker who didn't want to treat the gay customers the same way he treated the straight customers, and he said he should be allowed to get away with it because his discrimination was motivated by his faith.
And if that was a black person and a white person who were getting married, I mean, look, that there was plenty of religion that saw that as a sin too, right? I mean, theoretically, you could say, hey, you can't buy anything in my cake store because it's against my religion, my religious values. The idea of a black man marrying a white woman, that's no, God doesn't want that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little unclear where the Supreme Court's going to draw the line. So in Hobby Lobby, Alito said that he thought that race is probably too far. You can't use religion to justify race discrimination. But he very pointedly did not say you can't use it to justify discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. He did not say that you can't use religion to discriminate on the basis of gender. I mean, one case, this was decided in the 1980s. There was a private Christian school out in California that didn't offer health benefits to its married women employees. So if you're a man, you got health insurance. If you're an unmarried woman, you got health insurance if you work there. But if you're a woman and you're married, you didn't get it because their religion said that the husband should provide for the wife. And, you know, the court struck it down. So no, you can't discriminate against women in that way. Under Alito's framework, under Gorsuch's framework, I'm not sure that case would come down the same way. I mean, they very well may say that you can discriminate against women so long as your faith tells you to.
Well, I guess we should be thankful that at this point they're not. It does not appear that they're ready to say that your religion can allow you to discriminate against racial groups. So we have that to hang our hat on.
We have that to look forward to.
Ian, thank you for that good news today, because that's about as good as it gets, I think. I don't know. Is there anything else that you feel like we should know today other than, if you live in Maine or Alaska, you better camp out in front of one of your senator's offices.
Yeah, like obviously, like, you know, if you live in Maine, like Susan Collins should be hearing from you right now. Like, stop what you're doing and call her right now. You know, go to her town halls, yell at her whenever you can. And the same if you live in Alaska. I mean, the other thing I guess I'll close on is that we don't know how bad things will get. You know, I mean, I wrote the piece where I looked at a bunch of 5-4 decisions where Kennedy was in the majority and, like, now they're going to flip. Like, I can write that piece. But the thing that has been so frightening about the Roberts Court over this last decade is how unpredictable they are. You know, if you had given me a copy of Obamacare in 2008,
right,
and said, come up with a legal challenge, come up with some sort of non-frivolous constitutional argument that could be made to challenge this law. I mean, I'm a pretty good lawyer. I probably could have come up with something, but I never would have come up with this like herpity-derp inactivity, activity distinction that got five votes on the Supreme Court.
In
like,
terms
that,
of
that, that was not
from, and the Medicaid expansion.
Yeah, I mean, like, yeah, I mean, maybe I could have come up with that, but I mean, like, the theory that was used to challenge the individual mandate, like, never would have occurred to me. I don't think it would have occurred to most lawyers, because it was in nowhere present in, like, not just in the majority opinions of the court up to that point, but in the dissenting opinion. Like, there was just no clue that this was coming. And so, like, these guys are creative. They're going to pull things out that we have never heard of before. And when they get up to the Supreme Court, it all depends on which side of the bed Chief Justice Roberts got up on that morning and whether he wants to be, you know, straight in the line conservative John Roberts that day, or whether he wants to be, I still care about the institutional legitimacy of this court, John Roberts that day.
All right. All right. So with that said, I guess the other thing that people can start doing is start mainstreaming the idea of we need 11 justices on the court rather than nine. Right. I mean, that's what it's coming down to.
That is, I mean, if I were John Roberts, I would be very afraid of that. Because, yeah, I mean, there's nothing in the Constitution that says there has to be a nine-justice court. The next president could come in and sign legislation adding 15 seats to the Supreme Court if they wanted to. There's nothing in the Constitution that prohibits that. And, I mean, there's lots of reasons why court packing is a move of extraordinary last resort, because what you're doing is you're destroying the legitimacy of the Supreme Court when you do it. But if this court overreaches too much, you know, if it becomes an entirely partisan arm of the GOP, then I don't know what choice the next president is going
to
have.
So, for instance, if they like do a one-off where they select who the president's going to be, something like that, if they really overreach in that manner.
If something like that were to happen.
Right.
Yeah. No, I mean, like, things have gotten really bad. But, I mean, what I'm talking about is, like, you know, if the court were to eliminate the possibility of free and fair elections,
right?
And, you know, there's an election coming up, and we can either run it under Sam Alito's rules, or we can have a democracy.
But Ian, where do we draw that line? I mean, when they start disenfranchising voters, when they start coming up with rules that say, like, oh, you know, if someone takes two votes on something that's racist, then it's not racist anymore. I mean, that's the problem, right? Isn't it? It's like if they say we're, you know, no more elections. OK, I mean, it becomes pretty clear. But that's the problem of the whole era that we're in right now, isn't it? Is that we don't know.
Like, no, I mean, I'm working on a whole academic paper trying to lay out when court pack, like when the trigger point is, when it becomes acceptable. And I mean, I think the mere fact that we're having this question should frighten the Chief Justice. Like, if the Chief Justice has any sense, he's going to realize that. I mean, like, you know, people weren't talking about court packing 10 years ago. Like, you know, it was an insane tactic, because you weren't going to use it against ordinary disagreements. But, like, if the court decides to, you know, the reason you don't engage in court packing is because doing so eliminates the legitimacy of the court to do the thing that the court needs to do.
But shouldn't the Merrick Garland episode have illegitimized the court? I mean, that seat, the natural course of things was disrupted, right? I mean,
right.
You know, you could argue that that was court packing. It was an extra.
Yeah.
It wasn't an unconstitutional move, what he did. It wasn't a breaking of the law. It was just, you know, not, it was a different norm. And, you know, why didn't that hurt the legitimacy of the court?
So once you pull the trigger on court packing, you're going to trigger two things. One is that if the Republicans ever regain control, they're just going to do it again, and their folks will be worse and more lawless. And then the second problem with court packing is that if you destroy the legitimacy of the Supreme Court, then you know Mississippi is going to feel comfortable saying, well, we're just not going to obey that marriage equality decision.
Right.
So there's a real price to doing court packing. I mean, it's not something we should do frivolously. What is so frightening about the moment we are in right now? I mean, court packing is the equivalent of launching a nuclear strike against your enemy because they are fueling their missiles right now. And if you don't take out their silos, it's going to be you first. That's what court packing is. And that's the only circumstance when it should be deployed. And the reason why this moment is so frightening is because there's a possibility that we will get to that point.
Ian Millhiser, justice editor at Think Progress, author of Injustice. Thank you. I appreciate your indulging me, and I know I held you way too long, but crazy day.
Oh, no. This is great. Thanks so much.
All right. Thanks, Ian. All right, folks. Now we're going to go late today, obviously, with the free half of the program, because prior to the program today, I interviewed Jane McAlevey, because in addition to the huge crap show that we have now entered in terms of Anthony Kennedy's retirement, and I mean, look, I think this summer is going to be nuts. And we can talk about some of the other reasons. There are very smart people who I think that we're going to see some indictments over the summer. And so who knows how that implicates this stuff. But what is clearly we don't have to speculate on is that As of today, public sector unions cannot require of people working in the public sector, in unionized shops, municipalities, state workers, county workers, cannot require an agency fee, which is a payment that pays for the administrative costs of negotiating contracts with employers. As you know, municipalities, counties, states, they don't have the resources to negotiate with every highway worker that they hire, with every firefighter, with every cop, with every sanitation person, with every state social worker. You'd have to, there's so many employees, it would be impossible to wrangle. And so what they do is they say, we're going to negotiate with the union. The union is going to represent everyone. So, however, now, because of the way that the Supreme Court resolved the Janice v. AFSCME case, you have a bunch of freeloaders who may decide, like, I'm just not going to pay for those administrative costs. Why would I? And so Jane McAlevey is a great person to talk to say, what next for unions? We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Jane McAlevey on this special post pre-apocalyptic episode of the Majority Report. We'll be right back. I could sleep. I could sleep. I could sleep. When I lived alone. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program Jane McAlevey. She is a labor activist and author of No Shortcuts, Organizing for Power in the New Gilded Age. And Jane, welcome to the show. We were just talking before we started to record that I was saying it really, I guess, is the new Gilded Age. But you were anticipating where we are today as opposed to maybe where we were 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. Well, and I even said, first of all, it's lovely to be here. It's great to be on your show. It actually always is. So I think when I wrote the title of the book, it was partly because it was clear to me that we were heading back to a Gilded Age. It's been feeling right from the crash of 2008 to high rollers on Wall Street to messing with the entire economy and not caring to, you know, crashing the value of every working person's retirement plan by crashing, you know, the mortgage crash that we had. There's like a disregard that's been palpable and rising for the masses of the workers in our country. And by the masses, I mean like 90% of people, right? There has been this, you can see in the Peter Thiels, in the Jeff Bezoses, in that you can feel a sort of a return to a 1920s style country. So to me, it's been obvious that it's coming. And sadly, I feel like it is actually here. Oop, one sec.
So we've spoken about Janice V. AFSCME, I think, at least a couple of times. We've been anticipating this case in some respects for really the past couple of years, because first version was Friedrich's, similar issue at hand, and then Antonin Scalia decided to leave his bodily form and leave the ability for public sector unions to easily fund themselves, at least their what the work they were doing for their members. And now we have Neil Gorsuch, and we have this new case, Janice V. AFSCME. Just, I mean, like I say, I think this audience is pretty familiar with it, but just sum up what the case was. And it was decided yesterday, right before Kennedy retired. But just sum up the case for us.
Sure. I mean, at the most simple level, I say, look at Donald Trump's tweet from yesterday about this, where he says, lots of money will be taken out of the coffers of the Democratic Party. Terrific ruling. I mean, that sort of sums up what the purpose of the case was in his own presidential tweet. But what the case did was that it said essentially, if you belong to a public sector union, meaning a teacher, firefighter, you know, anyone who works at any level for any form of government at the state, county, local level, you can no longer be you can no longer pay what's called an agency fee. So it's Byzantine. Let me just say it this way. Since 1977, the U.S. Supreme Court, in a case called Abood, made a decision that in the public sector, workers who work for the government would not have to pay union dues. But there was a compromise in 1977 which said, look, the truth is we have a system called exclusive representation. Every worker has to be represented by the union no matter what. But there's a compromise if they feel like their political values are different than their unions, for example, like who the union endorses in political races. You know, a worker should not be forced to support the political objectives of a union if they disagree. That's 1977. Let's just say I feel like that was the golden age right about now. But anyway, back in 1977, the court ruled there's a formula that we've all had to play with, but, you know, there's a formula that they issued that you essentially deduct how much money goes to politics and advocacy work, and you come up with about 70. It averages about 75% of a worker's dues, called an agency fee. And the agency fee, though, is something that if there's a union in the facility, then a worker can choose not to be a member of the union, but they must pay what's called the agency fee, right? So they're paying for, like, the service, the representation, the benefits of collective bargaining. So that was called an agency fee, and that's been settled law, as we used to think of the law, the former concept of settled law, which we're about to rip up entirely right now, right? But so the concept of, you know, that being settled law, by the way, like Roe v. Wade, like many other things that they're about to rip up. So this is just, you know, one of many. So sorry about that. Hang
That's
on just
right.
one sec, or should I just keep talking through
no,
it? All right. So
just keep talking. We know you're in an airport. That's fine.
Okay. All right. So I thought I didn't come into this room. But anyway, so essentially that was 1977. And what they did yesterday, it technically would sort of say that the agency fees can no longer be charged. The problem is, in the way they did the ruling, there's far more dangerous. There's a lot of danger that floats around this ruling. So first of all, what was the point? The point was to facilitate, you know, the next Gilded Age, really. The point was to take us back to the 1920s, to be perfectly honest. That's where they're going. The Lochner era, I mean, they're taking the goal of the people who took this lawsuit. This was funded principally by the Uline family. I don't know if your listeners know much about them. It's good to go Google them, right? They're, and I tweeted yesterday, I included a good New York Times piece that gave a breakdown of the primary funders of the case. So, you know, for anyone to think this is some innocent guy who's like, didn't like his union, I mean, it's, you know, horse crap, right? This is a very strategically engineered case. Friedrichs was the first round. Harris v. Quinn was the first round. It goes back to Knox v. SEIU. I mean, they have been doing to labor law what they're doing to the Voting Rights Act. And they're doing it on a parallel track, which is like every session they engineer a case that's going to challenge some part of the Voting Rights Act, some part of affirmative action, some part of labor law. And it's been death by a thousand cuts, but some cuts are much deeper. And this cut was like to the jugular, right? So so that's the decision that they made yesterday. But what they had to do, because public sector law is different than private sector labor law. Private sector labor law is governed by the National Labor Relations Act, the NLRA. So this did not cover private sector workers, which we know are down to about 6% of the, you know, workforce, right? So who they were going after, they were taking their aim at, very strategically, they were aiming at where there are still large numbers of workers and unions, at the power and financial base of the trade union movement, which is the only sector capable of advancing any kind of pushback on the billionaire class. So this is super strategic, really well thought through, really well planned, decades in the making. They've been going at it, going at it, going at it. So what's unique is that under public sector labor law in the United States, it's not governed by the NLRA. It follows a lot of the same ideas laid out in the National Labor Relations Act, right? But public sector laws are governed state by state. So, of course, you have these like state rights guys just eviscerating state rights, by the way, right? At the same time. So they literally, these are like Mr. the black robes of the state's rights people. Oh, except when it comes to workers' rights, right? So they throw state's rights out. They engineer the case to call it a First Amendment case so that they can create national decisions about a state's rights issue fundamentally, which is public sector labor law, which has always been governed at the state level. So they knew what they could not do was mess with unions in states like New York, California, Oregon, Washington, Massachusetts, like all New Jersey, like all of the states where unions are still strong, where we have better benefits, better, where workers have better lives, where we have rent control, where, you know, all, like where the climate is better for the working class. They knew that the Democratic leaning states, the so-called blue states, would never gut unions in the way that the, you know, more conservative states did long ago. And so they had to engineer, strategically engineer a case that could take what has always been a states' rights issue and make a national decision to gut the financial power of the working class in this country. And that is what they actually just did. Now, it's not the end of unions. It is not. I certainly don't believe that. But if you think about the immediate cycle, like now to 2018 elections, they just blew a hole in the financial resources available to not just unions. It's the financial resources available to the Democratic Party, in essence.
Right. Because what's happening, I mean, just if I could. What's happening, and my understanding is, I think maybe it was SEIU, was already pulling back funding in anticipation of losing and nobody knows for sure how much revenue they're going to lose, because it's an opt-in type of situation. And my understanding, it's also there was also elements of Alito's, I think he is the one who wrote the opinion, that will also raise the bar for the opt-in process, that it's going to make it even harder than just like a decision, but it's going to be that much harder for people to I guess avoid the enticement of a free rider situation. Now, let me ask you this. So yes, it's going to starve resources from the Democratic Party. It's going to starve resources from the any of the operations of the unions. And they're going to need some time to sort of like readjust and have confidence who's going to pay these fees going forward, I guess. And so that now is the time not to spend any money. It's to find out how much they're going to have in terms of revenue. But, you know, let me just ask you this. I got a message from a postal worker the other day who said, you know, we're basically an open shop, but we find that in the context of the way that we work, it's pretty hard for people to avoid paying their fair share because there's a considerable amount of pressure. How much of the future is going to be a function of that when we talk about unions? Or how much is it going to be a function of the unions reforming and changing the way that they do business? What's your take on both?
So a couple of things. One is, yes, the postal workers. So in 2003, the lovely old George Bush Jr. there, he did this already to the federal workers, sort of on the heels of the Patriot Act. He like just snuck it in there. So most people don't understand that all federal employees were sort of forced into right to work back in 2003. So that's, and that's what I mean by the death by a thousand cuts. And there's been a series of executive orders, by the way, if we have time, we should get back to, that were also just issued by Trump several weeks ago, that are the next devastation to the federal employees. So we could come back to them. But so postal workers, right, they've been living under the system since 2003. So have all the federal workers unions. I would say a few things. One is, the postal workers have very good leadership right now. So congratulations, like good job electing good, smart, progressive leadership. And that's part of the message here. If you have, visionary, smart, and let me use the word small-D democratic, high participation, trade union, you're going to survive this. You're going to survive it, but some people say, well, that's an argument to do it. No, it's not an argument to do it. Like, we need good unions anyway. But the idea that people are going to, it's immediate. Like, the law goes into effect immediately. There's no transition period. So people, even the next human resources all over the country is going to be going crazy, like in the next week, trying to figure out. I mean, there's going to be a lot of money immediately gone. Then it's an opt-in system. So, like, yes, we'll survive it. And look, the best evidence that we're going to survive it, and we can, if we do our work right, continue to lead the fight back in this country, which is what labor has long done, is looking at West Virginia, right, and Arizona, and Oklahoma, and North Carolina, and all the states where we saw the most incredibly beautiful militant struggle this year in the streets, putting real pressure on, winning things themselves, for themselves and their families and their communities. They also live already under these rules, right? So I say to people, look at what happened in West Virginia. They already existed under right to work law. They already didn't have agency fee. They don't even really have the right to collective bargaining in the same way that people in sort of so-called democratic leaning or blue states do. So when 34,000 workers in West Virginia decided, we're not going to wait for political solutions. We're just going to walk off and try and fight for our health care and fight for a raise and stop charter schools and stop privatization and everything else they did. And they won. So like in the happy, positive news department, we need a lot more of West Virginia. And I don't mean that kiddingly, I mean that for real. Like the only,
and just to clarify, when we're talking about these states, we're talking about teachers, and we've covered that. But let me, teachers always seem to me to be best situated to leverage their labor in these circumstances, because on day one, they have already developed deep ties with the community because of the nature of their work, right? I mean, as a parent,
exactly.
I know I want access to my teachers all the time, and I'm going to develop a relationship with the teachers of my children, and there's immediately I'm an ally of theirs. With my sanitation worker, the guy who works on fixing the street, I don't talk to those guys. I don't, I may say hi and this and that, but I don't have a personal connection. How do unions develop a similar relationship with the community that teachers have, as like part of their, as part of their job on some level?
Yeah, so one, you're right. And by the way, postal workers, similarly, like people actually like their postal workers right. generally. They know that they know them. Postal workers, I mean, I'm going out on a limb here because I don't actually have a statistic in front of me, but I think the postal service has been one of the most impressive sources of employing African-Americans and African-American women in this country. So, yeah. like, there's a solidarity that runs deep for a lot of reasons in the Postal Service, right? They see each other all the time. They've got, you know, sort of fixed schedules. They build relationships. And a lot of them still do know their community in the same way that you're expressing about your teacher. And certainly in No Shortcuts, right, in my second book, I talk specifically about that there will need to be strategic sectors going forward to build a new labor movement as they're coming at us. And I say, right, I argue for several chapters, like it's going to be healthcare workers and education workers who are mostly women, a lot of people of color, and who have profoundly deep relationships organically to their communities, right? So I'm super in agreement with you that this is like where we have to go. Now, the question is, so what if they have less relationship? What do they do? What I practice as a negotiator and an organizer and what I write about as an author and theorist is something called whole worker theory. And by that, I mean, when I'm working with workers in a big campaign, the first thing we have to do is understand the power relationships among and between the workers at work. So that's like task one if you're an organizer, like who leads who, you know, who's the most trusted worker, whose opinion will other workers follow if they're nervous or scared when the boss starts, you know, bearing down on them in either a unionization drive or in a tough contract fight. And it's essentially doing what I call power structure analysis among and between ordinary workers in the workplace. Part two of that work, to survive right now and for us to push back against the coming end of the entire New Deal, which is straight where they're going. These guys are not messing around. So let's come back to that. But like what you have to do to build more strategic relationships from all workers is you have to secondarily begin to chart. And by chart, I mean literally chart, like in one-on-one conversations, rank and file led. Like I train workers to do it with each other. So they go out and they say, let's make a social survey of every single person in the community that our family is connected to, our church, our little league, our soccer club. If they're not education workers, their kids' school, their PTA. Like we systematically start to chart the social relationships that the workers themselves hold in the community. Then we begin to bring the workers together across big workplaces and, you know, geography, any given, or, you know, a state, a locality, wherever I'm working. And we say, now you're going to go, and that takes a while, right? It's painstaking work to like begin, and eat people, it's like, it's a serious organizing conversation. People are like, what do you want to know, you know, where I go to what my church is or my synagogue or my whatever. So, you know, it's based on a trusting relationship. And then people can really do this. And, you know, we did it again in the big 2016 campaign I was running. So, and then instantly you begin to see where does the worker base itself already have well-trusted, well-developed relationships in their community? So it's actually a systematic, methodical approach to structuring and building deep relationships between workers into the community because they've already got it. So most unions just don't get this step of like, the workers don't
identifying
leave at work.
What assets already exist in terms of relationships.
Yeah.
All right. So.
Yeah. Like they do these top down, we're going to build a labor community coalition. And it's like the union leader goes and writes a check to some community group.
Right.
And that's so much weaker than realizing
where it already exists
the community
organically.
Is there.
Yeah. I get that. And that, all right. So let me ask you this. That's the perspective I would take if I would go in and I'm working with unions and I would say, look, the step is let's assess. I mean, that's, you know, if someone was to come in and look at my business, that's the first thing that they would do, too. I think they would say, let's see how many hits you're getting on YouTube. Let's see how many, you know, where is the most fertile grounds for opportunity to expand the reach of your show? Not like I have a one size fits all for every show, despite what they're already doing. And so, but what if, what do people who are listening to this show, who aren't involved in a union, who don't have access to, you know, suggesting, hey, you know, even if it was amongst their union buddies, like, let's map out where we have relationships and put it together and take a look at the thing and focus on building out from the existing assets we have. What do you do if you're just someone who's on the outside and you don't even, you know, have a connection to a union? What is there anything that we can do to support that moment where, you know, somehow we are touched by a union or we are, you know, asked to join a union on a picket line or to engage in a protest? I mean, how do we apply these principles to a non-union context?
So I wrote an article years ago called Organizing Unions from the Outside In. And I want to draw a little bit on that idea of what you're speaking to. So the first thing I just want to say, because it really does affect everyone, like the way you're describing that you've got plenty of listeners who are, I mean, most workers are non-union, right? So obviously most of your listeners are probably not a union either, because that's the country right now. So this ruling is absolutely going to affect every single listener listening to this. This decision was not about trade unions. This decision was about the big business billionaire class rolling back the final legs of the New Deal, by which I mean Social Security. They're closing like an office every several weeks right now. Like there's so much going on in the actual news every day by the distractor in chief that people don't even understand what they are doing every day. They're like, they are getting ready. Like this, I keep saying to people, this is not a decision about unions. It's a decision about corporate power. And their aim is to have small, tiny government, small, tiny worker organizations, and big billionaire corporate class businesses running this country. And they are talking about the 1920s. So I say to people, like, hold on and get ready for the fight. So if you don't have a union yet, by the way, it's a hell of a time to try and build one. And I'm not kidding. Like, as a reaction to this, you know, people who don't have one, there's plenty of people listening who could form one. So one, start thinking about how to do it. Secondly, if you were, like, I was working with some pastors in Philadelphia a couple of years ago in a big campaign with nurses, and after we had built relationships through the workers themselves, there came a point when I remember going into a Sunday church, in this case a black church, where the minister packed about 7,000 a Sunday in, right? These are huge places. So black church, downtown Philadelphia. And I went in, it was after we won, and, you know, the members of his congregation who were part of the union, because we built the connection that way, you know, he was thrilled, like, by learning that unions were somehow still around. I mean, I remember him telling me, like, he remembered the civil rights movement and King and sanitation workers, but, like, he hadn't met, like, modern unions, right? No surprise. So there was a moment, fast forward, we win. The members of his congregation who had built the relationship between themselves and their new union formation and his congregation asked, you know, me to come in. And I wouldn't go until the end, one, because I just was flat working 20-hour days at that point, right, trying to get the contracts done. But also because I feel very strongly that the relationship has to be held between the workers themselves and the community that they belong to. But so finally, you know, it's over. That's the time when I usually say, okay, let's go meet these great pastors who are, you know, coming on picket lines and speaking and preaching. And he called me up onto the you know, like in front of the whole congregation and said, everyone who has a union should meet her at the end of this. Everyone who doesn't have a union and wants one should talk to her. She's going to be in the back of the room. And for the rest of us, we need to figure out how to talk to her to build unions and support them. And it was, you know, to like thousands of black unorganized workers in Philadelphia. So people, if they're of faith, whatever your faith is, you should be going in and working with your religious leader and saying, why don't we make an announcement that it's time to start figuring out how to support working people and ask everyone in the congregation to put their hands up. Like people can start to do the same kind of charting from the outside in is my argument. Like, how do you support a union? So if you have a community of faith, you could do it the way I just described. Like, let's actively start saying it's time, just like it's going to be time to stand up and support affirmative action, women's rights, the Voting Rights Act, black people, brown people, name it, fill in the blank. They are rolling the country back as fast as they can. So I think it's up to everybody to figure out and understand and see that this attack is on our democracy. It's on the republic. It's against our communities. It's against the entire country if you're not in the 1%. And so one is form a union. Secondly, PTA, Parent Teacher Association. And, you know, if you're a parent, walk into the school and say, I'm going to run for office in my PTA, and then make sure that your PTA is ready to stand there supporting your teachers, and not just the teachers, but all the education workers, right? The bus drivers, the cooks, all of them. Like, we are, it's that time, it is time for a level of solidarity building that we have not had in my lifetime. And there's no more time to wait. The level of urgency, especially with Kennedy's announcement, like, you know, we just went to, like, fire. Like, we're at a four-alarm fire in this country, that with the Kennedy announcement especially. And what they did to unions and what they did, you know, you can purge voting lists. We are, it's going to require a level of solidarity building and people deciding they're going to do one less fun thing, you know, with the kids, because they're going to bring the kids to an action. They're going to do one less, like, we're at the moment where we're about to lose the entire New Deal and most good things that came after the New Deal, unless and until people stand up in numbers that we haven't seen. And I'm not talking about going to the next protest. Like, that is not what I'm talking about, right? Like, go to the next protest, that's fine. That is not how change is going to happen in this country. People have to walk into their parishes, their congregations, their synagogues, their PTAs, their community group, their soccer club, and start talking about, we need to support workers. We need to support unions. We need to actually be ready to stand up and act in our communities to defend each other. And that's already been true, right, of Latinos and undocumented people. So we just have to sort of say, they're coming to build internment camps. They're coming to roll us back to the 1920s. It's within everybody's power to start deciding locally in their communities how we're going to build community-based solidarity among and between people in our community and among and between the working class at the workplace.
Jane McAlevey, No Shortcuts, Organizing for Power in the New Gilded Age. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks, Sam. Take care.
Thank you.
All right, folks. That is the end of the free show today. And just a reminder, you can join us in the fun half, or you can just support the free show by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. It is pennies. A number of pennies a day. And if you had this many pennies in your pocket, it'd be so uncomfortable that we'd be doing you a favor. And in fact, in special instances, we sometimes send Michael. That's where Michael is right now, actually. People are like, where's Michael? He's out collecting. Sometimes we go to some folks who have just too many pennies. And he goes and he picks them up and brings them back here. What's that?
He takes them to Coinstar.
And
we don't want to deal with those.
No, but sometimes there's enough pennies that sometimes he has to take two trips. Folks, join themajorityreport.com. Join themajorityreport.com. Don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. It's great coffee. It's a win-win. Really a win-win-win situation when you think about it. Fair trade, co-op, 10% off, support the show.
Caffeine.
Four wins, five.
Win-win-win-win-win.
We're up to five wins.
Got to win sometime.
Exactly.
So tired of winning.
Don't forget, Jamie's got a new episode today, right? Patreon.com/TheAntifada.
Yeah, it should be dropping later today. I was going to post it last night, but I was writing an op-ed and I was tired, but I'm going to post it today. This week on the Antifada, we talk about why capitalism is bad and communism is good. So check it out.
There you go.
But it's like really nuanced.
There.
That was tanky Lena Dunham.
Are we on the fourth Saturday? What Saturday are we on?
Yeah, there's actually like five Saturdays in,
It's completely screwed up, literary hangovers.
No, I appreciate it. It gives me extra time for, studious preparation, but, the YouTube, page is up to, I think about 100 subscribers already.
So whoa, look at you. Look at you. So do you want people to do it on the YouTube page?
I figure YouTube, I want to grow that YouTube thing. Well, because you need to reach a certain amount of hours and subscribers to get
hit the partnership status.
Someone hit that partnership status.
All right, folks. Then you can subscribe on iTunes, but
the preferred way of listening to Literary Hangover is on YouTube.
Yeah, and visuals and everything.
Oh, do you have visuals?
Well, I mean, we're going to add some more actual documentary visuals, but now it's just an audio waveform and the logo.
Okay. And so it's always fun to watch that waveform, particularly if you're...
I love watching that.
Yes, well, let's not, you know, you want to go full disclosure on the waveform? I mean, you need... All right, folks, quick break. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. You can call, be a part of the program, and or you can IM us. I know the Android app is not available for the time being. We're working on it. We had a little bit of problem. I don't know what it was, but if you want the app on Apple, you can get it at majorityapp.com. All right, see you in a minute.